Nomoto presents American presidents. Nathaniel Gorham, acting president of Congress, 1785 to 1786. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 25 minutes. Nathaniel Gorham's turn in the chair began not with trumpets, but with the small, exacting necessities that keep a weak government from collapsing into embarrassment. The famous man elected to preside, John Hancock, emblem of independence, governor of Massachusetts, a name large enough to be a logo, was largely absent, held at home by illness, comfort, and the quiet calculations of a state politician who knew where his power actually lived. Congress could not wait for a celebrity's joints to loosen. It needed someone who would come to the room, count the votes that existed rather than the ones a letter promised, and convert the country's nervous energy into minutes, resolutions, and dispatches that made the semblance of union feel a shade more real than the day before. Gorham, a compact Charlestown merchant with a ledger's memory and a neighbor's practicality, took the gavel in the absence of the president and did what New England men do when ceremony fails them. He set a rhythm and held it. In late 1785 and into 1786, first as acting chair under Hancock's airy title and then as president in his own right, he gave the Confederation precisely what it could actually use: speed, order, candor without theatrics, and the courage to admit that the frame itself was failing and needed something sturdier than exhortation. He had been bred for the unglamorous kind of authority. Born in 1738 in Charlestown, within smelling distance of Boston's wharves, Nathaniel Gorham came up through the counting house rather than the college. He learned arithmetic in service of invoices, geography in service of cargo, and human nature in service of credit. His world trained him to know the difference between a promise and a payment, a contract and a hope. He bought and sold on the waterfront, kept his word because a merchant without reputation is a man without oxygen, and learned the politics of proximity, how to arbitrate quarrels between men who would see one another tomorrow in the same tavern and could not afford to make hatred permanent. When imperial policy turned the harbor choleric in the 1760s and 1770s, Gorham did not pretend to be a theorist of sovereignty. He was a citizen who wanted a government that didn't insult him and a market that didn't cheat him. He entered town committees, helped organize boycotts that felt like civil commerce rather than riot, and drifted by degrees from protest to administration. The war pushed him, as it pushed many practical men, out of the shop and into the council chamber. He sat in the Massachusetts General Court, on the Board of War, on committees that requisitioned meat and powder, and settled the miserable arithmetic of who would be paid in what and when. He learned how to say no without making an enemy who will never forgive. In 1782, he took a seat in the Continental Congress, returned home, and then came back again in 1785, just in time to watch the national body discover what peacetime would really mean for it: creditors with punctual expectations, allies who measured obligations to the day, veterans holding certificates that depreciated while they were still warm from the press, and states that had discovered, like clever children, that they could love the idea of a union and still refuse to do chores for the household. He entered a Congress determined not to perform melancholy, and he set about refusing it. Hancock's second national election in November 1785 had been, in one sense, a pious act of remembrance. The delegates hoped prestige could add ounces to a scale that had too often favored state convenience over national duty. When the prestige did not appear in person, Congress reached for a custom that suited its habit of mild fictions. It installed a chairman to preside in the elected president's absence and kept the business moving as if the bones of the office mattered more than the flesh. Gorham took that role with the instinct of a man who has chaired town meetings where delays breed wrath. Start on time, keep the docket short and moving, do not permit the second speech to repeat the first. He did not pretend the gavel gave him powers the articles did not. He used the tools he had: agenda, referral, deadlines, and a gift for drafting resolutions that would not need three more resolutions to correct their grammar. The work that filled his table was neither romantic nor trivial. The Land Ordinance of 1785, adopted just before his acting tenure began, had set a grid over the West, townships 6 miles square, sections of 640 acres, a section reserved for the support of schools, surveys to precede sales so that claims would be rectangles rather than fistfights. That beautiful, ruthless geometry needed men in the field with chains, men at desks with plats, and a Congress that could keep all the paper aligned with all the miles. Gorham oversaw the administrative birth of the ordinance. He settled disputes about surveyors' pay and appointments, chased after reports with the politeness of a clerk who knows politeness is also pressure, and ensured that when parcels came up for sale, the advertisements went out on time, and informs that a farmer in Connecticut and a speculator in Philadelphia could both understand. He did not delude himself that lines drawn in Philadelphia would soften the fear in a village that heard axes across the river. He believed, stubbornly, that the only alternative to a measured republic was a frontier of private empires, and he was determined to have the former. At the same time, he lived with the Confederation's financial absurdity as if it were a neighbor you cannot avoid, the impost plan still stalled by the jealousy or caution of states that preferred the fragrance of sovereignty to the smell of revenue, requisitions that sounded like commands and moved like suggestions, a superintendent of finance trying to turn promises into notes that would not evaporate between camp and counter. In letters and minutes, you can hear Gorham's tone, brisk, patient, edged with Massachusetts thrift. He pushed adoption of the revenue measures with the candor of a shopkeeper telling a customer the terms are not insult but necessity. He wrote to governors with the formality due equals and the urgency due debt. He did not denounce. He reminded, and then reminded again. He understood that under the articles, shame was a power. He used it without sneer. The foreign correspondence that crossed his desk looked, in the abstract, like ceremony and, in the concrete, like survival. British garrisons lingered in the old Northwest in violation of the spirit of peace. Their officers wrote as if the Americans' failure to restore Loyalist property and pay British creditors entitled the Crown to interpret the treaty as it pleased. Spanish officials in New Orleans flexed their control over the Mississippi with compliments as sharp as knives. French ministers wanted less improvisation and more punctuality from their Republican friends. Gorham's job was to make a legislature look like a chancery, letters in elegant paragraphs that did not tremble, with seals that impressed neither too lightly nor with ostentation, admissions of difficulty that never read like confessions of impotence. He kept the tone even. He sent thanks to courts for births and condolences for deaths because etiquette is one of a weak state's weapons. Act like a nation long enough and other nations will act as if you are one. None of that would matter if the national chamber could not do the plainest thing a legislature does. Sit and decide. Here Gorham's experience in Massachusetts paid out daily. He kept quorums alive in months when roads were rivers and taverns were warm. He sent discreet notes to laggard delegates, offering no sermon and no excuse, just the pointed arithmetic of absence. He coaxed committees into reporting on the day they had promised rather than the day they preferred. He cut long speeches short without humiliating the speaker. The Confederation lacked an executive in the modern sense. The President of Congress was a moderator with a pen. Gorham used the pen like a metronome. In a government where action depended on tempo as much as on law, he kept the time. The West, which had been drawn into squares on paper, remained a tangle on the ground. Treaties at Fort Stanwix in 1784 and Fort McIntosh in early 1785 had written borders that native nations did not uniformly accept and that American settlers bent as easily as a twig. Militia officers wrote letters that read like complaints and like boasts. Territorial speculators wrote letters that read like patriotism and like invoices. The administration of the West required a kind of double vision. Respect for the fact that the land was already home to sovereign peoples with their own claims and consciences, and insistence that the United States act through rules, not through whoever had the most rifles that week. Gorham presided over the ratification and revision of instructions to commissioners, weighing words that were never quite equal to the task. He was not naive. He had seen men's appetites draw borders faster than surveyors could. But he remained convinced that if the Union did not insist on method, then violence would. The articles he signed were small barriers against a flood. He signed them anyway. The other flood was political, and it rose in the state that had made him, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where a tax system constructed to restore public credit fell with the weight of a goal on men already stripped to bone by war and drought. In the summer and fall of 1786, while Gorham's national chair still creaked under him, and then shortly after he took the office in his own name, Western Massachusetts filled with petitions, then with musters, then with marched threats against courts that, to the farmers who gathered in fields, looked less like instruments of justice than like stamping presses for foreclosure writs. This would become, soon enough, the episode named after a captain, Shays, though the discontent exceeded any one man and any one county. Gorham watched the crisis ripen with a double obligation, as presiding officer of a national body that had not the slightest power to keep a single state's peace, and as a Massachusetts politician who knew every inch of the road between Charlestown and the Connecticut Valley, and the ways a sheriff can be both a citizen and a symbol. He did what a national officer could do under the articles. He kept Congress poised to receive any legal requests for aid. He ensured that intelligence moved quickly from Boston to the chamber and then outward to the states. He drafted resolutions that said, with careful plainness, that a republic cannot endure if courts are shut by crowds, that liberty as practiced with pikes is indistinguishable from license. He did not scold. He refused to flatter the insurgents with words that made their methods sound like rough virtue. He understood the economic grief under the rancor. He had balanced ledgers through too many lean seasons not to understand, but he refused to let the national record excuse the assault on process. It is easy, from distance, to accuse a merchant of siding with credit against people. The deeper reading is that he sided with forms because he had watched what happens in a port when forms die. The strong take what they can, the weak pretend they consent, and the market becomes a rack. By May 1780, since the fiction of acting had worn thin, and Congress, weary of waiting for Hancock's health to change the weather, chose Gorham president. The title changed little about the work. It changed the temperature. He could speak with a clear voice when foreign ministers called, and he could sign with a less apologetic hand. The calendar did not forgive him for the promotion. The impost still languished, dependent on unanimity that had become a joke told by men too tired to laugh. New York guarded its harbor revenues as if sovereignty were a chest of coins. Rhode Island, suspicious of any instrument that put national fingers on local trade, preferred sermons to signatures. Gorham persisted, not with grand speeches that would please posterity, but with the weary pastoral tone that says, again, your honor is arithmetic and arithmetic is destiny. He was part of the growing consensus, shared by Hamiltons and Madisons and Jays and Washingtons, and even by reluctant state men who feared consolidation, that the country could not be governed by a Congress which had to beg to be in session and beg again to pay the candles. The Annapolis Convention, called in September 1786 ostensibly to talk about trade barriers among the states and actually to talk about the structural impossibility of solving them under the Articles, arrived within his tenure. He did not summon it. He did not attend. But he helped ensure that when its thin attendance chose, at Hamilton's pen and with Madison's breath behind it, to recommend a broader convention at Philadelphia in May, the national body did not swat the suggestion as an insult. He guided Congress toward the resolution that gave the Philadelphia meeting a legal fig leaf large enough to clothe a revolution of forms for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. He was too honest to think the word revise would survive first contact with a quorum of ambitious mechanics. He was wise enough to know that a frank authorization to write a new constitution would have torn the country along its anxious seams. His gift was to manage the passage from what the law said to what the law needed without breaking either. None of this meant he was a theorist. He was a manager with a tolerance for truth. He said aloud, sometimes in private letters and sometimes in the way he arranged the agenda, that the center could not live on compliments, that a nation cannot borrow forever on character, that the articles made dignity performative rather than enforceable. When critics called him a closet monarchist, which they would later, when rumors traveled ahead of the Philadelphia meeting and anti-federal fears needed faces to attach to, he could point to a record of Republican habit, rotation in office, insistence on committee controls, a merchant's suspicion of grand designs. The point was not that he loved a strong executive for its own sake. The point was that he had held the weakest of presiding offices and knew that a state cannot be run by minutes alone. There was another side to him, less visible in national chambers and more vivid in the ledger books of New England, his appetite for land. After his national service, he would join Oliver Phelps to purchase from Massachusetts the Commonwealth's preemption right to a vast tract in western New York, the famous Phelps and Gorham Purchase of 1788. That plan, mixed of speculation, hope, and the dream of a gentry built on title rather than on cargo, would end badly for him as depreciation, hard terms, and the deep uncertainty of Indian title combined to crush the enterprise. But in 1786, the urge already stirred in him, a sign that the new nation's future was not merely in laws and ports, but in the great interior. If that ambition reads uncomfortably now, it read as ordinary then. He saw in the grid and in the bargains a chance at stability and at legacy. He pursued it the only way he knew, by paper first. Even in that, he behaved as the same man who had held the gavel, attempting to turn appetite into contract rather than into conquest, insisting that signatures precede settlement even when signatures were, in practice, preludes to dispossession. In the chamber, he was remembered as unflappable and unpretentious, a New Englander, without the chill that makes other men bristle. He spoke without ornament and favored verbs over adjectives. He treated Southern planters with the same measured courtesy he used for Connecticut ministers. He had the knack, rare and precious in small rooms, of letting a man's pride remain intact after you have told him no. He was not above annoyance. He could, in private, be tart about delegates who loved the sound of their own scruples more than the nation's needs, about states that imagined their harbor's tides could be regulated by local moonlight, about the way petty insults between delegations swelled to consume days while the Treasury's chest sat moth-bitten. But annoyance never wrote his public sentences. He saved those for the business that might keep soldiers paid in something better than promises and keep foreign courts from treating the United States as an entertaining experiment. To see the dignity of his year, it helps to imagine a day in the middle of it, no particular date, with nothing spectacular on the docket. The chamber is thin, weather, illness, the elastic demands of state legislatures that pull delegates home for a vote. He surveys the benches. Counts silently. A quorum by the skin of its teeth. He raps lightly, calls to order. The minutes are read and approved. A report on the sale of townships under the land ordinance, problems with a river line, a question about a school section where the ground is rock. A memorial from a group of officers who have discovered that 5 years' commutation is worth less on the road to the bank than it looked in camp. The paper is referred again to a committee that will return with the same conclusion as before. Justice is a fraction. A letter from a French consul, satisfied with some nicety observed and anxious about a debt not met. Another letter from a British commander about posts on the Great Lakes, full of smiling insinuation. He guides the body through each item without letting it sink into complaint. He arranges that the hard questions will be asked by men who can bear the answers. He closes the day with the same formula, adjourn to tomorrow morning, trying to make the word tomorrow sound like a promise kept rather than like a threat deferred. What he did not do is as instructive as what he did. He did not romanticize the Articles into a charter they were not. He did not pretend the Union could be saved by more celery in its diet. He did not turn his chair into a rostrum for self-advertisement. He did not pick gratuitous fights with men whose votes he needed to keep even the simplest resolutions alive. He did not scold the public, though he had good cause. Smugglers who called themselves patriots, statesmen who called themselves Republicans while behaving like viceroys, newspapers that preferred rumor because it tastes better than budget. He did not indulge the fantasy that virtue could replace revenue. He did not confuse civility with delay. His firmness was the sort you notice only when it is missing, the habit of showing up, of saying exactly what the paper can bear, of admitting that the engine sputters and still insisting that it is an engine and not a prayer wheel. The measure of his usefulness appears sharply in what came after. In May 1787, he took his seat in the Philadelphia Convention that would write the Constitution, and there he served again as a chair when it mattered, presiding over the Committee of the Whole when Washington left the room or when debate needed a man who could keep tempers under the legal boiling point. He did not design the new frame by himself, no one did. But the document's texture, the way it assumes that meetings must be held, that officers must exist, that budgets must be made of numbers rather than wishes, bears the impress of men like Gorham who had spent the previous years discovering how thin a nation can be before it disappears. He supported the new charter because it gave the center the two things he had lacked, a purse to be held in common and an executive to be blamed when blame was necessary. He did not worship either. He recognized their utility. He returned, after national service, to commerce and to that great land scheme that would leave him poorer than he had arrived. There is a soft tragedy to that ending, a man who had labored to make paper into power undone, in part, by paper that could not force the future into the shape he wanted. He died in 1796, not old by the standard of a century, and not nearly celebrated enough by the standard of ours. He left behind no grand treatise, no quiver of letters directing armies or lectures on liberty that modern schoolchildren recite. He left habits. He left a record that, read straight through, sounds like a steady drum in a season when a steady drum may be all that kept the marching from scattering into a crowd. To say that he was an acting president is to risk shrinking the achievement into a footnote. It is better to say he acted, and because he acted, the office mattered at least as much as it could. He took the chair when a famous absence might have made Congress ridiculous and made it, instead, slightly more serious than its powers justified. He shepherded the grid of the West from theory into practice, so that the schools that would teach the children of a republic were assigned ground before the churches or the taverns. He kept the foreign correspondence crisp enough to be believed and domestic resolutions prompt enough to be respected. He looked directly at the Articles' weaknesses and helped arrange the legalities that allowed the country to replace them without pretending that revolution was repair. He is the kind of man a republic too easily forgets, neither saint nor villain, but the neighbor who runs the meeting, balances the account, and knows when to adjourn before the room turns sour. If you want a final image, let it be this. The tall window open a few inches to admit air that smells faintly of the harbor, the sound of cartwheels on stone, the scrape of a chair as a delegate rises to propose one more amendment to language that has been polished enough. Gorham's fingers resting on the table, not drumming, simply there, his eyes moving from speaker to clerk to the paper that will outlast them all, his voice, when he uses it, placing the question cleanly, so that even a man who will vote no feels that his no has been given a fair hearing. This is how weak governments survive long enough to become stronger ones, by the daily courtesy of exactness, by the discipline of schedules, by the refusal to let the perfect become an alibi for indolence. Nathaniel Gorham practiced that craft without complaint. He left behind a nation better able to practice it for itself.